there a writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week, we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us.
Good morning, or afternoon, or night. Happy driving. Hope everything's great with you, dear listener. Welcome to another episode of Words to Write By. Just wanted to give you a quick reminder that when you are at home behind your computer, if you'd like to hop on meetup.com or go to our website, www.wordstowritebypodcast.com, you can join our process group. It is free and it is very fun. We've curated quite the community, and I think we would all love to meet you, whoever you are, dear writer. Anyway, it's fun. You will notice that there won't be an episode next time in 2 weeks because Kim is going on an epic adventure.
If you are one of our listeners that listens on the day of the release, I would like you to feel for me and my family as we leave for a trip to Japan for the next 3 weeks.
Exciting. Mm-hmm. You will be missed, but I'm assuming you'll send me pictures.
Yes, okay. There'll be pictures.
Of your adventures. Mm-hmm. That is quite the adventure. Have you ever been to Japan?
Yep, I was there about 20 years ago, in the 2000s. But I was not there with a teenager and a 12-year-old, so that will be different.
They'll love it. Yep. One more thing. Mm-hmm. Don't forget, we have a tip jar.
Yes.
We haven't mentioned that for a little while because we kind of forgot about it. But we are using these nice, fancy microphones that was paid for by credit of future episodes and hoping that perhaps our listeners would hook us up and maybe go to our tip jar and give us a tip. Not a lot, if you don't want, but it's on the website. It says tip jar. It's really the Buy Me a Coffee website. So if you like the sound quality and you're enjoying the banter we have created for you, please go to the tip jar. That would be awesome. And that is all.
But there's way more to come. So next we have an interview with an editor, and we're going to talk about draft rewrites.
Hi, I'm Kristen Tate. I run a business called The Blue Garret. I work with authors doing everything from developmental editing to copy editing. I'm excited to be on the podcast again.
So in our previous podcast, we discussed Anne Lamont's editing process on her second book, and it's extensive.
Yeah.
The type of editing that she did, would you consider that developmental editing?
Absolutely. I would call that developmental editing. From her description, she tore up that book at least a few different times.
Is it common that you get a client with a book that needs to be torn up?
Yes, especially a first book. It's really not uncommon. And I try to prepare folks for the amount of work that they might have to do. And I haven't read the novel that Lamont is describing here. And now that I've reread this chapter, I want to go back and read it and just see if I can pick out the traces of maybe older drafts in there. But, you know, it sounds to me like she knew the characters, she knew the setting, and what she was missing was stakes. Like the stakes were not high enough for what was going to happen to these characters. So, you know, she's talking about doing things like putting more pressure on them or making things pay off. And that is something that is a typical first novel problem. People have spent a lot of time thinking about their characters and who they are. They've often spent a lot of time thinking about their setting. And they may have spent some time thinking about their plot, but they haven't necessarily braided all of those things together to come up with a book that readers who don't know and love these characters are going to care about. And that's where the stakes come in. Things have to happen to these characters. And I do sometimes get first books where there's not enough happening, or we can't decode why something happens, right? Sometimes I'll get a book where the author knows what the ending point needs to be, but we can't trace the kind of emotional or psychological logic that gets the character there. Usually that means that there's some kind of crucial stuff that has to happen in the middle. They have the effect, but they haven't built in a cause.
Do you tell them what needs to go in there, or do they need to discover it themselves?
I ask a lot of questions. I often will have ideas about what I think could go in there. And I often will tell an author, I have some ideas. I don't usually give them the ideas up front, because I find that if they can get there themselves, what they come up with is often surprises me and is actually more authentic for the book. So I'll write them down and I keep them in a separate document. And what I do instead is ask a lot of questions. They're kind of leading questions, but they're open-ended enough that it doesn't show authors a path, because there's like 10 different paths. There are 10 different ways they could solve that problem. And the goal is to get the one that's like most creatively exciting. And I think authors get more invested in the revision process if they can get that creative spark again that they had initially. And that generally comes not from like me saying, here's what I think you could do. It comes from them discovering it again. So the goal is to get them excited to go back into that discovery process again and find something new that they didn't know yet about their characters or about the plot.
Fantastic. What kind of techniques do you suggest they do to get to that?
So I like using something I just call a story spreadsheet. It's just a Google Sheet. A breakdown of what happens in each scene. Depending on the novel, there'll be other categories, like often backstory. So if this is, you know, the kind of novel that Anne Lamott's talking about, where it's psychological and it's emotional, and what you're expecting to see is whatever kind of demons are hidden in that character's backstory, they're going to come to life and spark. You want to build clues to those into the novel. So I track what we already know about that character's backstory and where we're finding out about that. If it's something more plot driven, like a mystery or a thriller, I'll also have a column like for clues or red herrings or that kind of stuff. I find that I need something that allows me to see the whole novel at one go. And I think the technique that Lamott talks about laying it all out physically, I think that's a great technique. And it's actually very similar. I know other writers, and actually I've done this myself with my own work with note cards. So you could do the same thing, kind of have a note card for each scene. And then what that gets you is you can do that reordering. And I often will do that with a spreadsheet. So one thing that I will often do is I will show authors a new structure. So, you know, I have kind of the structure they have there. I'll make a copy of that and put it in a new tab so they're not forced to look at it. And then I start moving some things around and kind of show them how they might untangle things and put it back in a chronological order, or how they might kind of braid the chronology a little bit more. Because sometimes I will see an organizational structure that I think could work better.
And that's kind of what she was doing when she was laying out all the pages.
Yeah.
And then there was another part where she talked about doing a plot treatment where she went in really in depth. So that's when your structure is set, but you're going for more stakes, or?
Yeah, I think it's about stakes, and it's also, well, okay, there's a couple of things that stage can get you. You can figure out whether the stakes are there. You can also figure out cause and effect. So these are related. Stakes are like your big climax and your payoff, and you want to make sure it's there. And then the cause and effect path, this is something that Lisa Cron talks about in her book, Wired for Story, which I think is so useful. You want to make sure that readers can understand the motivations, those causes, all the way through. And you also want to make sure that each scene has an effect. She talks about taking out entire scenes, and she murders some darlings. And those are often things where it might be a great set piece. And, you know, sometimes I'll read a scene and I can just tell it's one of the scenes that the author had thought up early on, and they just knew they wanted to use this setting, or there's like a line of dialogue or something. It's important to them and it's been in the draft all along, but it doesn't really have a reason for being there. Like, there's no effect from it. It doesn't change anything in the character or the plot. And then you kind of have to make a hard choice. Like, you either need to figure out a way to make it have an impact, or you've got to cut it. And that's hard. And then the other thing that you can do as you're laying out those pieces and rearranging it is thinking about pacing. When you have a big kind of disruptive scene where a lot happens, especially inside a character emotionally, often you'll want to have a quieter scene after that, so they have some time to do that processing work that we need to get some glimpses of, so we can see, okay, that was the cause, and now here's the effect, and then now it's going to cause some other series of actions.
Imagine that I am a client that has brought to you a mess of a novel, and you bring back the questions, and I'm like, well, maybe I should just like throw this away and start all over again. What would you say to that client why they should go through the editing process?
That's a good one. I mean, I tend to feel that these problems are all fixable. And I think when you have spent years often working with these characters, and you can hear this in kind of Lamott's words, these characters are important to her and she didn't want to walk away from them. And you don't want to walk away from years of labor. And I don't think that you have to. Doing the revision process will teach you new things about yourself as a writer. It'll teach you new things about how novels work, and you will take that knowledge into your next book. And so you'll just have a more intuitive sense of things like, are the stakes high enough here? Is my cause and effect pathway working? Does this scene have a payoff? And you'll be able to ask yourself those questions as you're drafting or as you're thinking through the plot of the next book. You might still make some of those mistakes, because sometimes we just have to make them, but you'll make fewer of them. So I just think it's such a good learning experience to go through that process.
Thank you so much. This is some great information I think will be helpful when I get around to doing my edits of my novel, and also for other people, because you're right, we put so much work into this piece and then it doesn't work out. And it's good to know that we can make the most of it.
You can. Yeah. Stick with it. Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Kristen. That was fantastic. And now on to the show. Okay. So we're starting a new section of the book. We are starting
part two, the writing frame of mind.
Everything before was about how to write, and now it's how to think about writing.
I'm assuming maybe it's like the theory behind the stuff, like your mindset.
You know, the most common advice, this actually was in the first section as well, was the whole butt in chair approach to getting writing. How do you write? You stick your butt in the chair and you write. My take on this is beyond that.
Right. We're starting to get into philosophical meanderings. Very similar to John Gardner, but less
hoity-toity.
Hoity-toity. Now, this one's called Looking Around.
Hot take?
So, like a few chapters ago, I feel like this one could be summed up from like the first paragraph to the last paragraph, and then she just goes around in circles.
Yeah, but we're still going to talk about it. So,
right. Okay, so here's one of the choice lines that kind of sums this looking around chapter. Writing involves seeing people suffer, and as Robert Stone once put it, finding some meaning therein. But you can't do that if you're not respectful. If you look at people and just see sloppy clothes or rich clothes, you're going to get them wrong.
Okay, so a couple things I had with this chapter. The first is, from my many years of doing mindfulness training, I thought this was one big shout out to mindfulness.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. Even though she never said it.
How so?
I think I can illustrate it by kind of talking about some of the phrasing that she used here. Like, you won't be able to present a character that's recognizable if you do not first have self-compassion. Self-compassion is a big thing in mindfulness. There is also the conscious mind seems to block the feeling of oneness so we can function effectively, maneuver in the world a little bit better. Then there's a sense of compassionate detachment. Oh, and the writer is a person who is standing apart but observing. So, like, this is all very common ideas that people practice in mindfulness, and yet she didn't say it anywhere in here.
I mean, well, given when it was published.
94.
Mindfulness, you would get it in the metaphysical bookshop. You wouldn't necessarily.
No. They were already putting meditating monks in MRI machines at that point.
Well, no, they were. But they were putting them in the machines to figure out what's going on. Now, at this point, we know what's going on. And
we don't know what's going on.
Okay. Well, we kind of know what's going on, and we're seeing that it's beneficial. But, okay, from a layman's point of view,
okay,
in 1994, my mom and her partner populated the house with crystals and Zen meditation books. And I was part of my sort of stepdad's meditation group. And I was like 15, and we'd all sitting in a circle. And these are like, you know, these people are like 30 years older than me. You know, they have the costume, the linen shirt. They've got the pillow. They have that round coin that's square in the middle, and they have it as a necklace. Zen stuff, just Zen stuff.
So what you're saying is it was still a lot more crystals and cosplay back then than it is now.
I think so, yes. They have scienceified it, definitely. You know, we've got apps. I think in the 90s, this was a little more woo-woo.
So she might have been avoiding saying it because she didn't want to be one of those people.
Or she is one of those people, but this is a book for general population and she didn't want to isolate anyone.
So part of it's because I have been doing mindfulness training for a long time. I use it for my writing, but I use it just to get through life and to deal with things and to process things. And so it's central to the way that I live. So there's nothing new here for me. But there's also not much new here, I think, even if I hadn't practiced that there. Like, it's about seeing the world, seeing inside people, like having a sense of looking. And the question is, would this be useful for anybody as a writer?
I would say that the way it is written is not helpful. It could be helpful, but I do not think this in the next chapter, and we'll get to that soon. But I feel like it's very vague.
Oh, it's very vague.
In general, I don't know if she herself knew exactly what she meant. I'm not sure if she was trying to adopt the kind of writing that would come with Deepak Chopra. Is that his name? It's almost like she's donning that kind of monk-like thing, and it's not helpful. It's not helpful for me.
Do you feel like you already know all this stuff anyway, or that it's just not accessible the way she wrote it?
I feel like it wasn't written for me. I feel like someone's getting it, but I don't. Like, I don't get it. I'm the person in the writing workshop reading poetry, and everyone's talking about the poem for like 5 minutes before I go, oh, it's about sex. Oh, I get it now. Like, I'm like way late to the party. Like, it just takes me a while. Reading this felt like that. I keep searching for something specific to like grab a hold to, and there's nothing there. Then my brain just goes, well, I guess this wasn't written for me in mind because I just don't get it. Or maybe I just don't get it because I'm not that bright. I don't know.
There is that fundamental problem when you're in a class or reading a book and you realize, I'm just not bright enough to understand this. I'm assuming it must be useful for somebody smarter than me.
Yeah.
So I'll just go along with it. And I hate that.
I do too, because I don't really believe it's true.
It's not true. It shouldn't be that way. So I was kind of trying to think about who this would be useful for. And I came up with this scenario. Let's say you are a reader of genre books, okay? Let's say that you love science fiction, you love the ideas of science fiction, and you want to write a science fiction book. And you write your science fiction book, and you think you put all this effort into it, and it's good. And people just say, you know, I just don't buy it. It just doesn't work for me. I mean, you got some good ideas, but, you know, it's just not there. It's kind of flat. It's kind of just not connecting. And you go back to all your science fiction books, and you look at all the stuff, and you're trying to pull stuff out of it, and it's just not working. And for somebody like that, who is trying to improve their writing, but isn't getting it out of the fiction books they're reading, what they need to do is they need to look outside of the book itself. And for that kind of person who's only been focusing on books, like what they see in fiction, to read this and to read it in a way that they understand it, because it's very easy just to skim through this chapter. This would be something like, this is how you open your eyes and see the world and learn about people as to write about real people in your books.
But there's no strategy in here.
No, it's not a strategy thing. You're right. That's fundamentally a problem with something like this, is that it's saying, look at this, all these things, and then assuming that you'll collect in your brain and make something out of it.
Okay, I think maybe what I'm getting out of this, unfortunately, is that I'm learning about myself through this chapter. And in this chapter, it makes you realize I distrust writers who are trying to sway me in a philosophical / spiritual way. And that's what I'm getting from this. It bleeds from, look how smart and elevated I am. You explain this to me. You explain this to me, because maybe I'm not getting it. Okay. Try looking at your mind as a wayward puppy that you were trying to paper train. You don't drop kick a puppy into your neighbor's yard every time it piddles on the floor. You just keep bringing it back to the newspaper. Okay. If that's about mindfulness, then it's that whole, like, you know, you sit there and your mind wanders and you try to bring it back, right?
Right. And the idea that mindfulness isn't a thing that you just get. It's something you practice every day. Bringing the puppy back to the newspaper is something you practice every day.
Right. But here's where it gets weird. So I keep trying gently to bring my mind back to what is really there to be seen. Maybe to be seen and noted with a kind of reverence. Because if I don't learn to do this, I think I'll keep getting things wrong. I honestly think in order to be a writer, you have to learn to be reverent. If not, why are you writing? Why are you here? What does that mean to you?
So when you've sold your first book and you're invited onto fresh air and somebody asks you a question about your writing, you know, there's that certain answer that people have that's very esoteric and very learned, and people say, wow, this person is a deep thinker. I've got to get this book.
See, I have the opposite reaction. This person wants to be seen as a deep thinker without actually saying anything deep.
And I think maybe that's my fundamental problem with this chapter. It's not quite a caricature, but it is what when writers are asked to explain their art and explain why it's meaningful in the world and why the world needs liberal art programs, because otherwise it's all going to fall apart. This is the language they use.
Right. And I hate it. I mean, it's probably my working class background, but seriously, dude, like, just get to the goddamn point. But my composition teacher brain pops in. And I look at this and I'm like, so I keep gently trying to bring my back to what is really there being seen. Circle there being seen. What is being seen? Be specific in the margin. Maybe to be seen, again, unclear, and noted with a kind of reverence. What do you mean by reverence? Because if I don't learn to do this, do what? I think I'll keep getting things wrong. What are you talking about? Things wrong? What are you getting wrong? Like, that's me and in writing in the margin from the composition teacher point of view. But from the poet point of view, or person who went to a creative writing department point of view, it still pisses me off.
I think you nailed it. I mean, I think that's one of the big fundamental problems here.
Okay.
Now, for the other side, let's look at it this way. As somebody that is trying to write a book, as someone that is giving up on other fun activities that people are doing, as somebody that is doing this thing that nobody wants to read in your family because they love you, but they don't actually want to read your book. As somebody that is looking at forums of other people that have been successful and like wanting that, and looking at forums of people that are unsuccessful and saying, well, I'm not that. Like, there's a little personal narration that goes on in your head that keeps you writing as a writer. And for some people, like you, it's very practical. And for other people, they need to have art.
This is an art.
Think of those times when you read prose or poetry that is presented in such a way that you have a fleeting sense of being startled by beauty or insight or a glimpse into someone's soul. And I think we've had this conversation about art in general, that you very rarely get this sensation.
I think it's dangerous to say you're getting a glimpse into someone's soul through their art. I've read lots of poetry where people are like, oh, now you'll get me if you read this poem I wrote. I'm like, no. We're a little more complicated than that. You're not seeing in anyone's soul. This is something that has been created. This is like something that has been reworked and reworked. And, you know, it's not raw like a soul. A soul is like a raw thing. And you can't really even peer into one. I guess I'm overthinking it.
But I think that there is a sensation, or I'm in a museum. And I see a painting and it just touches me and something just opens up in my mind.
Yes.
And
I've had that.
There is a sensation when you're reading a book where something just opens up in your mind. And it's so nebulous that anytime you actually try to get at what it is or what's happening, then it goes completely into bullshit territory, just like you're saying.
Right.
But there is something for at least me personally that does click, that does open up. Striving for that in your writing, or even when you're writing, having that moment is amazing. But you're not going to teach someone. I think that you include this in the book because you want to give people some sort of aspiration or some sort of this makes things more important. And it's fine to have that going on in the back of your head, but it's not fundamentally useful to make you a better writer.
I guess. I mean, that's assuming there's anything in here. Like, I really didn't find much of anything in here that made any specific sense. It was just not there. I mean, the end, the mind so frequently has its head up its own ass, seeing things in such a narrow and darkly narcissistic way that it presents a correctal theology offering hope to no one. Is that not what this is?
This is a very useful book if you want to have some of the phrasings and the presentation of sounded much more learned. So I would say this is a very good chapter to read several times through and just embed these ideas so that when you are a world famous author and someone sits down to interview, you can sound like a very smart and learned person.
I will never, ever do that. Dear listener, if I'm ever on Fresh Air talking about my book, I will not sound like this. Damn it. I will not.
Okay.
But I was kind of wondering, what is she reacting to in this chapter? I feel like she might be reacting to a certain type of writing. Not her trying to emulate that, because we discussed that. But like, is there a type of problematic writing she's trying to help writers get out of by writing this chapter?
I think there is. I think there's that kind of dead character story, where it's usually genre, but it's just that thing where you don't connect with the characters because they're not real.
Right. So it's like someone trying to almost write to a formula.
Like I said earlier, if you're reading a particular set of genre of books and you're just looking at how the writer puts it all together, you're getting a secondary source as opposed to a primary source. So if people aren't in academic or whatever, or you didn't get this in your English class, the idea is, you know, if you read a Wikipedia article or you read a autobiography of someone, those are secondary sources. You're getting it through a filter. If you're getting a primary source, you're going to the original document. And the thing is that books try to show life. And if you're only getting your writing advice from reading fiction and trying to imbibe it from there, but not going out to the real, to the primary source, the real world, you're going to be hobbled.
Right. Okay. But this is you trying to figure out what this is saying. It doesn't actually say any of that in here. It doesn't mention genre books. It doesn't mention flat characters. It doesn't mention anything like that.
Yes, it's not prescriptive.
And it drives me crazy. Like, like the student, just tell me what you mean. I lose patience. Yeah. You know, like I'm relying on you right now to tell me. It's like, oh, thank you. I can maybe get something out of this now. But if it was just me alone with this chapter, I'd be like, whatever.
And maybe she put it in there simply to raise the level of the expectation, like to make herself sound smart and learned and making this book feel much more, you know, profound than a prescriptive book.
Maybe. Yeah. Renee was not a fan.
No, I'm
You were a fan.
No, actually, I was not a fan.
Okay.
I found some interesting stuff there, but seeing how you react to it, I think that that's what most people are going to react to. I read it through twice. I underlined. I thought about it. We talked about it. Nobody else reading a craft advice book goes over this chapter like that. They just pass right on through and keep going because they want to sound at the good stuff. So, yeah, I don't think it's terribly useful.
Yeah, we gave it a chance. Wasn't for us. I don't know. Next chapter.
Let's move on. Next chapter. The moral point of view.
The moral point of view. So this chapter reminded me of an episode we did on Gardner. He had a chapter on this. I think it was our second or third episode. Anyway, yeah. I'll link it in the show notes. What'd you think of the moral point of view?
If you had to have a thesis for this one, it says, if you find that you start a number of stories or pieces that you don't ever bother finishing, that you lose interest or faith in them along the way, it may be that there is nothing in their center about which you care passionately. So the idea is, if you don't love your story, then it might get hard and you'll stop writing it. Unless you're a person that writes really fast. If you write really fast, you can just get to the end and you'll be done. But if you write slow, you have to love your stories. And you have to have an emotional core to them where writing them and writing them out gives you a satisfaction in and of itself because of that emotional core.
Right. It made me sad reading that first sentence. You know, you start a number of stories or pieces that you don't ever bother finishing, that you lose interest or faith in them along the way. I was like, oh, finally, she's going to talk to me. Like, because I have this problem, right? I thought, oh, I'm finally going to get the answer.
Nope.
No answer.
I think about the stories that I have started and not finished, and they are not because they didn't have an emotional core. There are other things that got in the way. I didn't have time. I didn't so much lose a connection to the core. It was still there. That wasn't why I wasn't finishing it or I abandoned them. But I think a lot of people do. Like, there's that whole business of basically looking at your novel and saying, there's nothing here. This is all just stupid writing. Nobody cares. And right. I don't care.
Right.
Do you ever stop caring about your writing and abandon it?
Sometimes. I've convinced myself that it's not worth anything and to move on to something else because it's just not going to work.
This is about trying to tell the truth in your writing. And this gets really nebulous too because, like, she never says what it is. She just kind of talks about it in a way that makes everyone think they understand right. What it is. And we all stand around nodding our heads and saying, oh, yes, you're very smart. I don't want to appear like an idiot here.
Right. And that whole the truth. Put quotes around truth to capitalize it, gild it. You know, like, it's okay. I mean, maybe at the time. This was poignant and interesting.
Back in the 90s, this was important. And then now we're just all over it.
Well, I mean, the 90s was only like, what, 10 years ago? I mean, it wasn't that long ago. And the joke never gets old. You know why? Because the 90s were our jam, dear listener. That's our age group.
That's when we were young adults and everything worked.
Or everything didn't work.
But we were still young adults, so that was okay.
And we didn't have to do our laundry because grunge was awesome.
I did get a couple things out of this. And one of them was that you can't tell the truth in a sentence or a paragraph. The truth doesn't come out in bumper stickers. And I liked this because, you know, you should be able to pitch your novel in a couple of lines. Pitches are one thing, but telling the truth of a story, like, why is my book important? Well, you can't just give that a sentence. Like, if you ask someone why their book's important, they'll talk for a long time and meander because it's really hard to get to what the truth of your book is or what your book is saying because it's complicated.
Right. Like, oh, she says, you end up wanting your characters to act out the drama of humankind. Like, I really like that line, but she says, much of this drama does not involve witticisms and shimmer. it's almost like, I think it was the last episode where we were talking about the difference between plot and structure.
Mm-hmm.
This one is more like, what is your novel about? Well, it's about these two characters that do this thing and they go through this adventure. And then what is your novel about? It's about forgiveness and love and redemption. What is it? What does that mean?
And forgiveness and love and redemption are really big things that, you know, you can use those words for it, but what really is going on is deeper. What it reminded me of was in eighth grade, we read To Kill a Mockingbird. Have you read that book?
I have.
Yep. And I remember the teacher decided that we were going to do some sort of like panel thing. All the people that read To Kill a Mockingbird sit up. She was going to ask questions. We were going to tell about the book. And she asked, well, what is the plot of the book? And I'm like, wow, there's a whole bunch of different plots. There's Scout doing this, and there's Boo, and there's this, and there's this. And just, and she's like, no. The plot is the black man that was wrongly accused and Scout's father defending him. That was the plot. And I'm like, that's like one section of a very long book. I'm like, no, that's the point. That's the plot. Like, you know, I'm going to give a shout out because this is the other thing I realized. The problem is that everybody has a story about a teacher totally screwing up, and they never pay attention to the other 230 days where the teacher didn't screw up. Teachers have it hard because, like, we only remember that horrible thing they did and not all the other stuff that maybe they did day in and day out. They're never going to appreciate it for that. But still, this teacher was wrong. And as an eighth grader, I knew she was wrong.
What was wrong about that teacher was back then they weren't teaching that multiple interpretations existed and that they had a book and you had to do a test and they wanted to make sure that you got the quote unquote right answer. But there wasn't a lot of time or freedom to investigate.
What I liked about the first thing was that there's not a single truth to your novel. So you don't need to feel bad that you can't sum it up in some pithy little truth that you say at a party and everyone goes, oh my God, I've got to read that novel because I've got to read what's in there. Whenever you come up with like the, it's about love and relationships and da-da-da, it's going to sound lame.
Right.
And don't worry if that sounds lame because it's the reason why you write the whole novel. And that stuff is all the way infused through it and that truth is there. So if you feel like when you actually try to summarize your novel and it sounds stupid and fake, that's okay.
Right.
So that was one thing I got out of it.
I liked one part, although, again, if students were reading this, they may not get it, but this made me think of students. She said, if you have a message, as Samuel Goldwyn says, send a telegram, but we feel morally certain of some things, sure that we're right, even while we know how often we've been wrong, and we need to communicate these things. For instance, I used to think that paired opposites were a given, that love was the opposite of hate, right the opposite of wrong. But now I think we sometimes buy into these concepts because it's so much easier to embrace absolutes than to suffer reality. Reality is unforgivingly complex. That, I'm on board. It makes sense because I've read so many essays where you absolutely agree with something, you absolutely disagree with something, and the world is black and white, but that's because you don't have, what's that thing that you get when you get older and it grows in your brain?
A brain tumor?
It's not a tumor. It's the thing, you're a teenager, you don't have it, and you can't understand future consequences.
Amygdala?
Amygdala! Your amygdala, is it? I don't know. You haven't grown your amygdala yet. It's not complete. Like completely there. So, you know, my students see the world in black and white because it seems black and white and they don't have nuance yet.
The reason why this made sense to you is because we actually are veering off of morality at this point. She's actually, I think, giving an example here of what she would write about and what she would be invested in enough to a book where she's writing a book where she wants to prove that morality isn't what just one way or another, that the opposite of love is not, that everything isn't paired opposites. And this little bit here is something that would drive someone writing to keep coming back day and day because they have realized that morality isn't paired opposites or that paired opposites aren't a given. And they are going to write a story where they show that paired opposites aren't a given. And it's going to be infused through the book. And when they sit down to write it, that's in their mind. And the fact that you reacted so strongly to this, the fact that you said that, yeah, that really resonated with you, that shows, by example, having a feeling like that about your book will help you write and will make you passionate about it.
Mm.
And that's what I took. Otherwise, it doesn't quite scan. That's an example of what she's talking about, but that isn't the core truth, because the whole chapter is far more nebulous. This is an example of what would work for someone.
Yes. No, I was just mentioning that she said a thing that made sense. And but there isn't much more that makes sense here.
I think treat that as an example for something that would cause you to write. So in the end of it, she has this thing where she says, so write about the things that are most important to you. But then she says, so maybe what you care about passionately is about fasting and high calories, I think. Cappuccino enemas say, this is fine, but we do not want you to write about them. So the thing is, write about what's important to you, but make sure that it's something that's really important and not something trivial that I think is stupid.
Yeah. I mean, any book could be good. I mean, cafe enemas are fine, right? It depends on how it's written. Maybe it's okay.
It's the fact, though, that she says, write instead about freedoms. Freedoms worth fighting for. Human rights begin and extend with your characters. So, like, the problem here is that she's saying, find something you're passionate about. Add that to the truth of your story, but make sure it's something that's actually important, because I don't give a damn about this other stuff here.
Well, that reminds me of Bradbury getting really angry in the play when he was watching the modernist play, Waiting for Godot, and he's just like, don't write like that. And it's like, wait, did you say, like, two chapters previously to not put yourself in a box and allow yourself to get influence from everywhere? But now you're saying, but not a modernist play. Don't do as I do, do as I say.
No? But don't make me read that other thing that you're doing, because I don't like it at all.
Right.
No, I think this is the fundamental problem, is that you tell a kid or you tell a writer, write about what you're passionate about. And then you look at what they're passionate about, and you realize that is so boring or so insignificant. Or you have someone that's really passionate, but they're not a very good writer, so it doesn't matter. I mean, all this stuff comes together in a very complicated way, and you can take out little piecemeal of it. And I think it is important to tell people, write about what's important to you, but realize that what's important to you might not matter to anybody else. And then, you know, you don't have an audience.
This begs the question then. You're writing your novel. Do you have a moral in mind?
I have so many morals in mind.
are they driving your writing? Are you taking your passions, not just of geek culture and, you know, bands, but are there moral philosophies driving you?
Yeah, there are. There is a feedback loop in my writing where I just get deep satisfaction about these characters. I sometimes even write little bits of fan fiction about the characters because I love them and they resonate with me. And at the same time, they're not very realistic. I do not think that people in boy bands are these people.
Right.
So, like, it's all imagined. And if you work that in, if you've got those layers in your writing, there is such a satisfaction about going to it. And the fact that I figured out how to do this with boy bands and Dungeons and Dragons says a lot about me.
Yeah. Yes, it does, dear listener. I can tell you from firsthand experience.
But that's mine.
It is.
All mine.
It is true. It is what makes you delightful. Yes. Part delightful, part interesting. All yes. Kim. Okay. Do you think Anne Lamott would read your book?
I don't know. I think that runs into that whole thing about make it important to you and then hope it'll be important to somebody else. And part about making it important to you is that you can't conceive of it not being important to somebody else because you care so much. So we'll see what harsh reality does.
So I think what I'm trying to get you to say is, like, give me a few philosophical adjectives that will be slapped onto your book. You know, like, oh, this book isn't just about a boy band going to a fantasy world. It's about love and redemption.
It's the power of friendship and believing in yourself.
Oh, there you go. Believing in yourself. That's a good one.
And the power of friendship.
And the power of friendship. There you go. You got it. There it is.
There it is.
I got her to say it, dear listener. You're welcome.
To throw it back at you.
Uh-oh.
So,
I asked for it.
One of the quotes is, the purpose of great writing is to reveal in ethereal light who we are. It's a very big concept, but I was wondering how this squares with the idea that memoir writing is cheaper than therapy. Like, when you're writing a memoir, are you trying to reveal an ethereal light of who we are?
I don't believe that's possible, so I don't really try. And that's probably my fault. My problem is I don't see it so much as telling truths. I see it so much as this happened. How can I twist it into something valuable? And I think that's a problem. This book
valuable is, for you or valuable for the world?
Valuable for the world.
Okay.
And me. Yeah, well, that's where the therapy comes in, I suppose. But that's where I keep hitting blocks, is because it doesn't feel valuable, which is becoming the point, or at least if there is a moral center to it. it's pointing attention to my nihilism, where it's like, what is the point of all of this crap that people do to each other? Because there's so much weird in it. Because, you know, people are weird and it's just weird. And it's like, why would you even bother? It seems like it took more trouble to be mean than it did to just... And the more I look at it, the more it's like, you know, there is no reason for suffering.
That's a pretty good truth right there.
There's no reason for suffering. There just is. And people are just assholes. And what are you going to do about it? That sucks because it doesn't make a very good moral for a memoir, because people don't pick up memoirs to get some fundamental truth out of the fact that there's no truth. Like, that's dumb.
I think one of the fundamental problems of memoirs, you're both striving to tell the truth, but you're striving to tell a story with an ending. And the two aren't necessarily the same thing.
Yeah. And at negotiating those two, yeah, it's creating a lot of problems for me, and I haven't yet found my way out. I don't know if our listeners are going to gain much from that conversation, but that's what I got, folks.
Right.
That's what I got.
So those are these two chapters.
Those are these two chapters.
This whole second part of the book is starting off really great at this point.
So this is the way this next section of the book is going, and we will have to see if we get more useful stuff out of it. Because people say this book really is important. And I think up until this point, we've got some interesting techniques that she uses, an interesting way of looking at things. I mean, the shitty first drafts, I think, is kind of unique. A couple of those things were unique at the time and very useful, but a lot of it's kind of repeat territory.
It would be really interesting to see if I could give a questionnaire to 100 writers and ask them, have you read a craft book? How far did you get? What's the furthest you've gotten in a craft book? Because I would bet, even though I have no proof, that people get to part one and they finish part one and they start part two and then they don't even finish. But that's just my theory. And I think that might be true for the other books. We've had the same, the diminishing returns theory of a craft book. They front load it with all the good, useful bits. And then it just starts to...
We'll have to see. That would be that.
And also, I don't think these chapters have much of an exercise quality to them.
What is a writer supposed to take from this? A beginning writer or somebody learning to write and get some advice? What do they do with these chapters?
I mean, they're a little bit like a cheerleader, rah, 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 and they're not that long. In my book, it goes from page 91 to 102. So we're talking about 11 pages here.
Well, you probably already do this, but, you know, I think one activity, which I don't think we're going to do because you're going to Japan, but one activity could be to download, you know, a mindfulness app. And every day for like a half hour, do the mindfulness app before you start writing.
And I was doing my mindfulness training at the beginning of the day before sitting down to write. I have actually used meditation beforehand. Actually, there's one here in that she talked about how just centering yourself with breathing for a few minutes before you start writing, like that'd be a good exercise to try out, or a good thing we could talk about at some point. Actually, that would be a really cool exercise.
Mindfulness? I mean, I could do it, but you're the one who has to go to Japan.
Yeah, I'm the one who gets to go to Japan. But that would be a...
be part of the process, like listen to your app for 30 minutes and then write and see if it helps.
We're not going to do it for this episode. We're going to end the episode here. However, I think maybe that might make for a good bonus podcast for us giving that a try. I think doing a week where we do mindful breathing before we actually start writing each time would be a very interesting exercise.
Yeah. Would we be using Healthy Minds?
I think actually, I was thinking of going go more simple than that. I was just going to say, if you were to actually just set a timer and do like 3 minutes of breathing.
That's it?
Before you sit down to write and just see... And do it every single time before you start writing. But like that kind of very basic centering, you know, we're not going to do this now. We're not going to do this till I get back from Japan. But on our one of our bonus podcasts, we are going to report on what it's like to spend a week where we are doing mindful breathing before starting our writing each day.
All right. And that will involve you telling me what exactly mindful breathing is, which is great because it sounds like it's good for me, like medication. But I don't quite know what's in it.
Right. That will be our exercise at some future date.
I got to say, I'm so happy that you're a scientist and you know all the science-y stuff. It's come in handy a lot.
I got to say, one thing about being a scientist sort of person or being trained is that you realize how little you actually know. The effect of any profession, like becoming a writer, you realize how much stuff doesn't get written. You get closer in it, and other people are like, wow, you know all about this. And part of you's like, yeah, I know that I don't know that much.
Right. You made that chapter, I thought, was like really kind of annoying. Right. You actually told me what it was kind of about. And then once you said it, I saw the pieces and I was like, oh, so at least now there's something interesting about it. You named the thing she refused to name.
I came up with something, at least. That's a hypothesis.
You did.
Okay, well, thank you guys so much for listening. And if you want to support us, we are obviously you're listening to this through Apple Podcasts or Spotify or something like that. See if there is a way to rate the podcast. Like, don't even necessarily give us a review. Just like, you know, there's a little test of stars, and add as many of the stars as you feel we deserve, plus maybe an extra one because you like us, and just click on that. The more engagement that our listeners give, the more likely people are to find this podcast.
Yes. And we like to think that we're helping other people, just like ourselves. I mean, this is totally self-serving. I mean, we're reading these books to become better writers, but we really hope that, you know, we're dispensing something and you take away something, feather in your hat when you go to write. And if you think this is helpful for other people, you know, share it along the way. One way to kind of share it is to rate us, because that puts us higher up on the markings. And then people who wouldn't normally find us will find us, and then they'll have a neat feather in their hat when they go to write. So,
and in a more personal thing, if you are even just kind of thinking about this process group and it sounds interesting, just check us out. Because, I mean, we get a lot out of that. And it's actually really fun to talk to you guys as well, face to face.
Yeah, we're not scary.
No.
Most of the time. At least I'm not. Yeah. Yes, I am. Okay, sometimes I can be a little intimidating. Just kidding.
All right, everyone. Have a great couple of weeks. And we will be back in July.
Be back in July. Have fun in Japan, Kim.
Totally.
Are you going to bring me something?
Oh, yeah.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smith-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
They talk like that, too. You're not going to go very far if you can't find a subject in a sentence. What up, bitch? I got pretty fucking far before I knew how to find a subject in a sentence, okay?